This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show former member of U.S. Air Force Security Forces, Special Agent, and current Detective Corporal of Mapleshade Police Department, Jeffrey Engel. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the military, his transition into the civilian law enforcement world, the differences between the two, working in Korea, the partnership they have in the UK, some career calls, his own powerful mental health story, the Boulder Crest program, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Jeff Engel. Enjoy. Well, Jeff, I want to start by saying thank you so, so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield this morning.
No, I appreciate it, James. Thanks for the opportunity to spend a time with you here for a little while.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
Well, planet Earth finds me in southern New Jersey. It's, a balmy 10 degrees outside today. I feel like Mother Nature's obviously made it the world, but, you never know what day. A couple days ago, it was warm. Now it's cold, and, we're all standing by the fire trying to keep warm. So South Jersey.
Yeah, I wish I could say the same, but it's gorgeous outside, so I won't show you the window.
That's all right. The sun's burning, but it ain't hot.
Yeah, those are my favorite days, though. I mean, I'm all for blue skies, and cold. That's fine. It's just when it's gray and wet and cold, like the England that I grew up in, that's a little demoralizing.
We were missing some rain for, almost seven, 8 weeks. I think we were missing rain, and then it just picked up from there and, off it went. So then it's rained and it got super cold. So here we are, but it is winter. So we got to embrace that, right?
Absolutely. Same as our summers here. They're brutal. Absolutely brutal. All right. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your story. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Sure. Yeah, so I was born and raised in a medium-sized town here in South Jersey, Pennsauken, New Jersey. And then mom and a dad, brother and sister growing up. Brother's three years younger than me. And then my sister, I think she's 9.5 years younger than me. My parents, my dad was a worked in a paper mill, started as a janitor. You know, in those times it was, you know, different for him, you know, because he had no college education, but, you know, grew up, was never got drafted in the military and, you know, went right into the workforce, brought himself up in, you know, sweeping the floors of just a paper mill, and then started himself all the way up to the third in command before the industry was taken over by, you know, other industries, you know, across the pond and whatnot. But it was just a paper mill and worked that way. And then my mom, you know, worked in a Navy base for a short bit of time when I was born. And then so when my brother came around, she wound up became a stay-at-home mom at that point and went from there. So Pennsauken, New Jersey was, you know, where I was born and raised and, you know, grew up from there and, you know, went to Catholic school for the first 9 years of my life. And then after that, transitioned over to the public school education system. And it was probably the best decision I had ever made. You know, my parents were adamant about the Catholic school piece just because that's what their whole upbringing was, right? However, for me, it was a much needed change of pace. And I'm, you know, glad I did what I did. And we're able to, you know, articulate to them that, hey, you know, I need to try something different, right? Because just Catholic school space wasn't really my style, you know?
I've had a lot of people on here who are second generation. So, you know, their parents immigrated to the U.S. And it's amazing hearing the immigration stories. Like, I just had a neurosurgeon on the show and his dad came from Mexico, started as a mechanic, worked his way up to an electrical engineer, and then his son becomes a neurosurgeon. But obviously, there's another parallel in the States of people that are American, that are born and bred here, you know, and their parents are born and bred here. But, you know, as you said, you know, their initial entry into the workforce wasn't through an Ivy League school, and they had to work their way up. And I think that's the real, you know, element of the American dream that I don't hear people talking about anymore, that in the States, the way the States are supposed to be, you know, dreams can come true. You can make anything of yourself. So when you've talked to your dad, what was it about that journey and his mindset that allowed him to go from sweeping floors to one of the highest in command?
You know, I think you look at it, you know, in his work ethic, and it still shows to this day, right, is, you know, he is a guy that is, you know, one is always given to me is, you know, never give up on your dream and what you're trying to do and achieve, right? So you work hard, and your work that and ethic you put into things, obviously, is what you reprieve out of it, right? So for him is, like I said, you start sweeping the floors, and then you start getting interested in the machinery, and then you start taking over the paper mill itself where they're running the forms and, you know, going from there, and then, you know, you jump into a management role, and then it just starts to expand and grow from there. And for him, like I said, it was his work ethic and drive is, you know, really what took him to, you know, where it is. And I think that's something, you know, not that we miss today, but it's a lot different, you know, in today's society. You know what I mean?
What was that shift in the paper industry? My family on my dad's side had a printing industry. And so again, you know, when the internet really kind of took off, a lot of that kind of dissipated. And then my ex-father-in-law, he worked for Georgia Pacific, and it was the same kind of thing. They were the huge, you know, paper manufacturers, and I'm sure they've seen a decline as well.
Yep. So my dad's industry was Willamette Industries to start over in Langhorne, Pennsylvania. And then that was bought, I think, by Weyerhaeuser and somebody else. But obviously, you know, according to the same lines, like corrugated box / paper industry. And like I said, that space, like I said, once it was outsourced, you know, across the pond, and his business was shut down, and, you know, they took over, I think it was a company called Domtar took over the business. But, you know, I don't really know the intricacies of that. Like I said, I was still young at the point when he wound up losing his job and separate stepping away from there. However, you know, the work, like I said, that he put into that is, you know, he started out there, you know, from just a young kid and, you know, kind of grew, you know, through his piece to get to where he was. And like I said, that alone, you know, showed a lot, because we would always go tour the plant and go out and see it and, you know, spend the time out there and see, you know, all these giant, I mean, I'm talking giant paper rolls. And you'd look at them, you're like, my God. But like, that was, you know, in the times when paper was still that big before it came in a little box, you know, 8.5 by 11. And they were cutting them up that way, you know, it was old, like the old school printers where you would have it that way. So.
What about the impact of the forced redundancy and the loss of industry? When you look at Ohio and, you know, some other areas that were thriving a few decades ago, moving those jobs overseas can have a detrimental element to the actual town itself.
Well, sure. I think it's interesting too, because you look at like the warehouses today, right? They're big, giant, empty buildings, and you know, mostly it's all made for now Amazon, and you know, all partial shipments back and forth, you know, to and from, right, from all over the world. Where these buildings used to be filled with machines and, you know, folks that were working hard. And like I said, this area, you know, can be seen for like Camden, New Jersey, for say, as, you know, Campbell, home of Campbell Soup, and, you know, RCA used to be down there, and, you know, you see the different, you know, place like that. But a lot of those places are now either on the ground or they're just a building, right? And it's not so much what it used to be. And his building's the same way, right? They took over and, you know, so, you know, all the equipment gets shipped or sent wherever they go. And, you know, they outsource it to wherever it has to go. And it's a shame because, like I said, a lot of good people lost their jobs, and you know, some stayed within the industry. And it was unfortunate to see, like, the folks that were educated were the ones that stuck around, you know, because they had the experience and the education to go along with it. With as the world evolved, you know, it was always pushed to get the paper. You need the degree. You need this to be able to advance. And you know, he never had that, so you know, he wound up having to pull the plug and go somewhere else, and you know, try to start himself all over again.
That's an interesting parallel with the first responder professions. There's been a real push to get degrees and those kind of things. And sometimes the ones that excel in that maybe aren't actually good leaders. What is your perspective of that whole philosophy of needing the pieces of paper versus the actual journeyman's path?
Well, right. And we can look at that, right? And you can see that, you know, with education, it's there, right? Like the more you're educated, the better your brain works. And it's because you're using your brain accordingly. But, you know, with experience comes education as well, right? And, you know, you look at the young enlisted folks. When I started out as a young airman in the military, and I'm sure we'll get to that down the road. But when you talk about how you work hard to achieve something, the education comes with the experience, right? So using your hands, using your brain, and going out and doing things, figuring things out, because a book's not going to tell you everything, right? So you still got to work around how you're going to get to what you need to do. And all that education grows with the experience and his perspective. And, you know, to this day, I mean, like I said, he's one of the smartest guys I know. Like I said, you talk about a lot of that kind of stuff, and, you know, he talks circles around me for whatever that is, but, you know, and he's never had college, but, you know, he's a smart man and, you know, knows what he's got, you know?
Well, I think I'm seeing this, you know, firsthand. There are college programs, there are community college programs, there are trade school programs that are phenomenal. And they're a very, very straight line to that profession or to that next step. But we've also got a very broken system in higher education where, for example, I did exercise physiology. And, you know, a lot of us were hoping that we would have all the tools to then go on and be, you know, high level coaches at the end. And that wasn't the case. It was very, very academic. And a lot of these paths almost groom people to be a professor to teach the very thing that you were just learning from rather than go into the real world and apply these things firsthand. And I think that's what trade schools and fire academies and police academies do really well. So, please jump in.
Yeah, I think there's a solid balance too, right? Like you need to have kind of both sides of it. And I feel like it's either, you know, it's kind of like politics, right? You're either here, or you're here, you know, but if there was a fair middle ground as far as like education with experience, you know, even with these kids going in high school and, you know, even, you know, my young kids, you know, my kids are little, right? And they're, you know, trying to figure out these math problems and trying to figure out how, you know, the education, like, you know, 1 + 1 is not 1 + 1 anymore. It's this whole long paragraph to figure out what 1 + 1 is now. And, you know, whether there's a science behind it, I don't know. But, you know, when you look at it in the grander scheme of things, I feel like experience and education have to work hand in hand with each other to, you know, to make the best product ultimately, which is why a lot of people in our communities in the police, fire, EMS, military, you know, they get both of it as well as, you know, the discipline component, you know, to kind of keep them on task.
Absolutely. All right. Well, going back to your timeline, when you were school age, what were you playing and doing as far as sports and exercise?
Well, I tried, you know, a little bit of everything. I started off, you know, peewee football. I did a little bit of basketball, very little, until I realized I couldn't jump or shoot a basket for the life of me. So I got away from that and then stuck mostly with baseball and soccer. And then as I kind of grew, you know, getting more closer to high school, I found wrestling, you know, one of the only sports you compete against yourself and others in the same aspect, right? Because it's just you and somebody else, right? And it's, you know, survival to fittest ultimately. Fell in love with wrestling, you know, while that never really turned into anything major, you know, it was still something I enjoyed and kept me active. I did that through, you know, the course of high school and then, you know, which led up to my, you know, military career. So,
well, let's get to that journey. When you were in high school, were you dreaming of the military or was there something else on your mind?
No, so I was always I was called a nerd alert with the artwork. Like I used to love to draw computer graphics and stuff like that was really big into my mind. Like I enjoyed trying just taking designs and making things and, you know, building stuff, and spent a lot of time outside as a kid, like I said, you know, messing around. So like the making and building and drawing and whatever, you know, having ideas and plans in your mind were always a thing of mine. And then shortly before that is, you know, I had an uncle who was a drill instructor in the Marine Corps. He's since passed, but, you know, was a very huge inspiration of mine. And, you know, he was always, you know, a hard charger. And I always saw that, but it was never something that I ever really understood. And like I said, you know, seeing that and knowing that the familial history of the military was something that was just very real, you know, but I had never really experienced it just because I, you know, it wasn't something we did when we were growing up. So, but it was always an interest, but it was nothing that had piqued me to get, say, hey, I'm leaving tomorrow to go out, you know, and join. And there was thoughts of it, you know, when I came to high school at the end. I'll never forget, as I was getting ready to graduate high school, we were going to do the buddy program going into the Marine Corps. And my uncle, who obviously was a DI, was, you know, came up to me and he's like, boy, you want to kill people for a living? And I'm like, nah, not really. You know, I just not really sure where, you know, where that's going to take me. You know what I mean? You know, cause I, you know, I have dreams and things that you know, what you want to do growing up. But, so I kind of throttled back of that and stuck with the EMS world, cause that was something I had done, you know, from like a sophomore in high school. I became a first responder and then transitioned to an EMT when I turned 18 years old. So that was kind of a space that I lived in. It was more to help people than to hurt people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do completely, 100%. I even said when, you know, if I was ever being forced to be in the military and be in a higher tier level, then the PJs would be the best fit because they're really like, you know, firefighters in the military, as opposed to the SEALs and the Delta guys that are, you know, running towards the bullets like you guys do in law enforcement.
Right. And I said, you know, taking myself to the military career, like, you know, when I joined the Air Force in 2001, it was prior to September 11th. And, you know, it was a thought of mine. And I had a real close friend of mine. She decided she was going to join the military. And it was like, you know, out of chance, I was like, you know what, screw it. I was either going to become a paramedic or I was going to do something else in my life. So I figured, why not join the military to get the experience? And I walked myself in the recruiter's office and signed the papers, and I was off I went.
Just prior to that, talk to me about your experience as an EMT. I think a lot of us, you know, we live in regular society, and then you end up, you know, working in a profession like law enforcement or EMS or fire, and you all of a sudden are looking behind the curtain now, and you're like, oh my, you know,
sure.
It's a pretty jarring reality when you're a young first responder. So what were those couple of years like for you?
They had like an explorer program for EMS at this first aid squad in a small town next to where I grew up. And, you know, I joined over there to, you know, keep myself busy and, you know, stay engaged in that, you know, so I found something I liked and started riding the ambulance, like I said, as a first responder. And, you know, we're, you know, riding the back of the rig and you're assisting the paramedics and you're assisting the grown EMTs with all the stuff, with grabbing the supplies and doing that. You know, but you're experiencing all the blood, guts, gore and death and everything else you want to see. You know, at a young age, right? And, you know, it just kind of became a thing. I got to carry a pager and we got to respond to calls and, you know, do all this fun stuff. But, you know, it kind of just transitioned and made me grow up a little bit faster, in a sense, just because you saw things and experienced things that, you know, normal people don't really ever really get to see unless you're watching it on TV or you come happenstance or show up on it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, walk me through your journey into the Air Force, and then what is your 9/11 story too? Because that was a pretty, you know, unique place to be just a few months prior.
Yeah, we all remember that, right? And you know, it's so I joined. I walked myself in the recruiter's office back probably February, March of 2001, and you know, after I said my good friend of mine, she had joined the military, and I walked in there and. You know, I met up with old Staff Sergeant Marcucci, who was my recruiter at the time. And, you know, I always had an interest in it and really wasn't sure where to go. And he's like, hey, come on in, sat me down and, you know, he's promising me the world. And, you know, they're salesmen, right? So they sell you everything they want you to hear, right? And, you know, it looked amazing and whatnot. So he wound up signing me up for security forces, which is, you know, military police for the Air Force. And signed the papers. And May 1st, I left and off I went to the Wild Blue Yonder. Went to basic and, you know, basic was just a run of the mill, you know, normal everybody experience kind of thing, right? You're yelling, screaming, push ups, sit ups, you know, run and move and learn and grow. And I transitioned right to the schoolhouse, security forces, always down at Lackland Air Force Base. It was hot, nothing I was used to, you know, coming out of the Northeast and you're down in, you know, Texas itself. So I wound up doing a schoolhouse there, and then we graduated. We graduated September 7th, 2001, 4 days prior to September 11th. And, we're doing our out processing. And while I was there, I hadn't gotten orders yet. And, we're all kind of sitting around and just waiting for our, wherever we were, our assignments were going to be, not predicting anything was ever going to happen, right? And then I was out processing at the dental clinic at Lackland Air Force Base when the planes hit the towers. And I can remember trying to call home, and, with home being up in the Northeast, you're like, in full-blown panic mode. I'm 21 years old, trying to figure out, what's what. Wound up finding my, getting a hold of my family, her, we watched on the news in the dental clinic. And then immediately after that, it was an all-call recall. We're thrown in a force protection con Delta, and, we're sitting on the gates, brand new certified security force members, sitting out there ready to rock and roll. And, not knowing what's going to happen, and everything then becomes a threat, right? And we don't really ever know what's happening there. And then 2 days later, I got orders to South Korea, which was kind of a wake-up call, because I never had predicted ever in my life to be flying overseas to spend time. And like I said, not knowing what's going on in the world, it was, definitely a wake-up call.
What was your experience in Korea? Obviously, the tensions have kind of, undulated over the last couple of decades. But what was your lens in that particular time?
So Korea was interesting. It was all force protection, right? So I was, I sat on a flight line for the entire year that I was there. And, in a Humvee, freezing and cold in the wintertime and hot in the summer, and, guarding F-16s and the A-10s that were there at the time. And, it was a little bit of a learning curve, because I had never, like I said, left the country or been out anywhere outside of my home state, right? So, to automatically be immersed right into Korean culture, it was interesting. And, downtown Osan was always interesting, because, not that it was ever, I always say it was like human trafficking was not really ever looked upon at that point. But when you look back on it, you're like, wow, like they would fly the Russians in, they would have the Filipinos in, they would have different cultures, in the bars working for the American, military members. And you would go in and you have to buy these little juicy cup drinks, and, they would drink so many of them, and then they got a free pass for the night if they sold so many. But, they would befriend you, and some would exploit information. It was kind of an interesting space, but you never really knew what they were or why they were doing there, but they were there, but they were always different. You never had the same people at the same places throughout the time. So eating the food and, kind of getting used to that culture was interesting itself, because I said, but I, I love Korean food now. It was just at that time, it was definitely, a culture shock, because, eating raw cabbage, kimchi, and, trying to figure out, what's what, these spices and all the things they got going on, it's a totally different animal.
There is kind of an arrogance sometimes towards the way we look at the U.S., we're the greatest country in the world. And it's sad, because there are so many countries that do certain things really well that if we had some humility, we could learn from. And just to preface that, if you look at us and how we rank in education, if you look at the obesity crisis, I mean, there is room for improvement. When you look at the Korean culture, were there any things that you remember, being impressed by that maybe would be good if applied here in the U.S.?
I mean, technology obviously is one thing. I mean, they're way up to speed on their technology. And I said, they're very humble people. I enjoyed, we had a guy that was, we became friends with. He was, his father was a, the mayor of the area, where we were hanging out most of the time downtown. And he got to take us around and show us the things, but like, just to see a different perspective at, 21 years old, and, how they live compared to how we lived, and, the way things were, like phones were a thing over there. And like, they were very well dressed, and like, they seemed to be trending on like styles and like things that, they had that way. And it was interesting to kind of watch and see, when you come home, it's like, oh, you got all this nice stuff. And then it's like, you get over there and it's like, well, it's different, but it's nicer than what we have here. But like I said, even with the food, and going back to that, is, their food's all, there's not all the junks in the food, right? So you're eating quality food, and, going out and like, you go to a mushroom house and you're eating all types of mushrooms, and not the trippy kind, but the just quality, wholesome food, built in there. And it was good. Like I said, it was very much a life changing experience to kind of give you a better appreciation for what we have compared to what we have here.
Absolutely. Beautiful. All right. Well, then talk to me about after Korea.
So after Korea, I went back, came to MacDill Air Force Base. That was in October 2002. So obviously we're still in the flight of all the chaos in the world. And, you know, they're still doing whatever they're doing here on the war of terror, and just everything's kind of ramping up at that point. And I arrived at MacDill Air Force Base. Again, like I said, living in Tampa, Florida was, you know, another great place. You know, Florida's always, you know, I always got a heart in Florida because I love that place. But it was interesting because I said the MacDill Air Force Base is centrally located on the the west coast of Florida, like in between St. Petersburg on the west coast and then Tampa, you know, right there. And at Tampa, you know, there's they always call it a Tampa Stand, but like there's Special Operations Command, MARSOX down there. You got Central Command. So there's a lot of different things happening at that base, and there's a lot of powerful people there as well. So when I got there, General Franks, I think, was the commander of CENTCOM at the time. And, you know, we had a couple different missions, which was law enforcement and force protection at that point. But we wound up, myself and my roommate actually from Korea, we landed on the Marine unit, which was probably the best job in the Air Force because, you know, we were the only 24/7 Marine unit active in the Air Force at that time. And we were on a boat, you know, patrolling the 7.2 miles of coastline back and forth, you know, on our shift. And, you know, we weren't bothered by flight. You didn't have to worry about dealing with all the noise of the base. And you said you go out on a boat and your whole mission was to protect the coastline, you know, and it was quite a surreal experience because it was an all weather thing, right? If it's raining, if it's, you know, it never snowed, obviously, but if it was rough out, you still had to go out and still had to do your job. And it was, you know, quite a remarkable experience, to say the least.
Obviously, if you think about like the Miami area, there's a lot of, you know, people trying to kind of immigrate from different countries in the Caribbean area. What were some of the things that you encountered when you were working in that particular role?
Right. So we would have a lot of people that were just curious. We had a lot of fishermen because around the base, they would have the mangroves and, you know, the different spaces where, you know, the snook would like to come run and hide. So you dealt with a lot of fishermen. But then every once in a while you would have because of what was going on there, you would have people rolling a boat and they would show up and they would penetrate the line and we'd stop them and challenge them and have a conversation. And you know, they really couldn't explain why they were there, right? And you'd kick them loose, you know, whether you were, you know, penning them out a ticket for, you know, magistrate court to go to court or just to capture field interview cards to capture data, right? We'd be out there just trying to figure out the why of what they're doing there. And then, like I said, you would see them on one side, then the other shift would deal with them a couple weeks later. And, you know, there was never really a rhyme or reason on why you dealt with them. But, you know, but we obviously know today that, you know, whether just collecting intel or trying to get that picture or just, you know, they just need to see something that show a pattern of life, you know, built into that space. You never really know where that falls, you know?
Absolutely. When I looked at your LinkedIn, it said special agent, but it said RAF. Is that attached to some sort of UK base?
Yeah. So how my career went, and like I said, a little further, and I'm still involved, you know, I'm still a reservist at this point. When I transitioned out of active duty, from security forces, in 2005, I had separated active duty and prior to punching the ticket to go out, I had applied to the Air Force Office of Special Investigations as a criminal investigator, and nothing that ever thought it would take me into that space. But, you know, I wound up, you know, finding it and, you know, met some folks when I was deployed for a short time in Kyrgyzstan downrange. But I talked to these folks and, you know, I'd really taken a peak interest in their job and what they were doing. So I applied, you know, on the reserve side and wound up getting picked up as a reservist for them and then said became a special agent. But what, you know, as that course of my career took me off is I'm currently assigned over at RAF Mildenhall, which is over in England. As my reserve assignment, which, you know, is obviously interesting in itself, especially as a reservist, because I only go a couple times, you know, a short bit of time in a year. So
interesting. And what is kind of an overview of the special agent role in the Air Force specifically?
Right. So we investigate all felony crimes related to the military, the Air Force specifically. And, you know, we have a dual hatted mission where we do criminal and counterintelligence work. Majority of that space is, you know, all it depends on what side of the house you work on. But a lot of times people come into the criminal side and they either find themselves going to work in fraud or they're going to go work in criminal or counterintelligence. So they're going to go work in, you know, a different section, you know, that does whatever their mission is going to be. And throughout the country, you know, we're on every base, you know, throughout there. And you said anytime something bad happens, you know, related to a military member or, you know, against a base or all these drones flying, you know, whatever it comes out to be, you know, we're taking a look at it to see, you know, what's going on and finding out if there's a threat to the base and installation. You know, we're detached, but we're there. You know what I mean? So
I've had quite a few people on the show, some of whom are victims of this, some of whom have just talked about it, but the prevalence of, you know, sexual assault within the military. What is your lens on that whole theme and how prevalent it actually is?
So I obviously can't speak numbers, but it does happen, right? There, you know, no matter where you are, and, you know, and I think it's very, very visible in the military side of things, right? Because it's so small, right? And the military force being as big as they are, but they're also very small, and you're not expecting to find stuff like that happen in the military, right? However, you know, when people are making advances or they're doing things to folks, whether they like it or not, you know, it's the perception of how one perceives it to, you know, portray it as, hey, he sexually assaulted me, or he inappropriately touched me, or, you know, it's a boundary, right? And some people come from different, you know, areas and don't see it as one way, but, you know, you raise the flag on it and, you know, it's there. I mean, it's very prevalent. I mean, it happens. It's not, nobody's, you know, invincible from it, you know what I mean? Because like I said, no matter where you go, whenever it is, you know, everybody's going to have an experience, you know, whether it's good or bad. And like I said, in that sexual assault piece, you know, some seem to be, you know, not appropriate, but like some are portrayed because they were told to do it and then not necessarily how they received or somebody else saw it. Right. And then it's our job to obviously figure out what happened. Right. So you find the facts and you present the facts to the command and the command makes the decision from there. Right. But, you know, other people are true victims of it. Right. And somebody else, you know, whether, you know, they went on a date and somebody, you know, did something that was not appropriate or, you know, so there's a lot of in between, you know, from there with both ends of the spectrum. Is it's very minor to very major. And like I said, it happens, you know, across the planet, unfortunately. And I said, especially when you're traveling across the way and like you've seen it where, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend or husband, wife are, you know, dating, one gets deployed and when they come back and then, oh, this, he sexually assaulted me. And it necessarily it may or may not have been, right? And our job is to find that. And like I said, sometimes you find out that they were having an affair and that they were just embarrassed and they said that that's what happened. But, you know, but that's our job is to find those facts out, you know. And like I said, we'll never take it away from the victims of a crime, right? Because, you know, they are true victims. And like I said, you want to make sure that, you know, they, you know, have their voice at the end of the day. And like I said, nothing to ever take away from them. But, you know, sometimes it's hard in our shoes to have to go down the path of having to experience their worst day, right? And then portray it to the command and your leadership to say, hey, this is what this person experienced and this is the why, right? And those facts will come out. And like I said, the decisions made with the command to make those decisions on how they're going to handle that, right? But it's sad, you know, it's sad to see. You wish it could never happen, but it does, unfortunately. And we obviously want to make sure that, you know, that the line's being held where it needs to be held and there's zero tolerance for it, right? Because it's just not acceptable.
Well, that was the military law enforcement side. What made you make the decision to get into, you know, the municipal side?
So my grandfather was a police chief he was a police chief in a small town. I never met the man, but like I said, he was supposedly a very stand up, you know, well-known individual and, you know, everybody loved the guy and, you know, he was, you know, the guy to go to. And my mom always talked high of him and, you know, getting out of the military, you know, at that time, you know, police work was very hard to get into, right? Like it was a very hard challenge to get into that space because, you know, you would take a test and then there'd be hundreds of people, you know, aligning to take a test and then you have to compete against them to get into the runnings of the police department. But, you know, we reversed back to when I left EMS going into the military. The town I worked in the town I worked in as an EMT. I had got to become friendly with a bunch of the cops there. And once I had known them, when I came out of the military, like, hey, you should come over and join us, took the civil service test and jumped into the police world. And, you know, going from being a military policeman to a civilian policeman was obviously majorly different, but it was definitely an experience to say the least. And that's kind of what drew me to that space. And, you know, once I found it, I loved it and I couldn't stop, you know.
It's so interesting hearing people that started, because I started, my first job in the fire service was 2004. And for most of us testing around that time, it was incredibly competitive. You know, my next one in California, I was against over 1,000 certified recruits in the actual written test. So that means that there were probably, you know, a lot more that were filtered out prior to that. Fast forward 20 years, and now we're in this immense recruitment crisis. Before I kind of load the question, what is your perspective on how we've got here?
Listen, we could talk about that 8 ways from Sunday in regards to how we got here, right? And, you know, everybody can have their own opinion about it, right? A noble profession by trade, for sure. I think that, you know, we went, like I said, in the recruiting crisis that we're in, you know, from convention centers to conference rooms is hiring now, right? Like, we started out huge, and now we're at the point where you're lucky if you get 5 resumes in for a hiring cycle. And, you know, I think politics has a huge play in it. I think that the media has a big play in, you know, the why of, you know, why people don't want to become cops. And, you know, the bastardization of police work over the last, you know, almost 10 years now, right, has really gotten hard for folks, because who wants, you know, obviously you meet people at your worst day, and then you're coming in and you're expecting to have the support of your team and your leadership. And, you know, I have a great team, you know, on my end, you know, but like I said, other agencies aren't so great, right? And they get the experience of, hey, this is what you're going to do. You're getting written up and you're getting jammed up for a bad guy's behavior. And you said, you're only trying to keep the peace. But again, like the military conversation where people assault each other, right? Like, there are good cops and there are bad cops. There are bad firemen, there are good firemen. There are good lawyers and there are bad lawyers, right? Like, but the problem is the bad outweigh the good on the TV, because then they exploit it and it becomes, you know, mainstream. And that's what makes it very, very challenging. And I think that if there was less of that, somebody said the other day, if the news wasn't 24 hours a day, it wouldn't be worth, it'd be worth watching. But now that it's on 24 hours a day, it's not even worth it, right? Because it's the same story over and over again. And if you believe it so much, you hear it so many times, you're going to start to believe it.
Well, what's sad as well, and I've had people from, you know, journalism, especially one, Larry Doyle, who was, you know, revered in that world. And he was the first person to interview Nelson Mandela after he was released and Saddam Hussein. And I was asking him, and he said, yeah, the moment that they switch from companies having the news just as news to requiring the news to make money, that's when this downward spiral hit. So you've got this 24-hour news cycle. It's not to keep everyone educated. It's to keep you stuck to the TV. So you'll watch their shitty laundry detergent commercial that they paid $1 million for. That's why they're trying to keep you on. So, you know, the more clickbait stories and the more, you know, defund or whatever the thing is. And like I said, yes, there are mistakes in uniform of all our professions, and they should be, you know, held into the spotlight. But the problem is they're presented as this is the entire law enforcement community rather than this is an isolated incident, or this is what happens when you have poor leadership in a department like Uvalde.
And I totally agree with you. And like I said, when we look at going back, and I think, you know, a lot of, you know, whether it was happening prior and it's just not seen, right? Like, but we know, you know, the incident in Ferguson, right? And how bad that created chaos in the world, right? But I often look at it too, like the community bank was just empty at that point. The folks there were just tired of, you know, whatever was going on there. And like I said, there was more withdrawals than deposits going into the bank, right? And at that point, it was a shame, because like I said, you know, when the incident happened, you know, it was sad, right? And like I said, nobody wants to see anybody get hurt. You know, we don't go to work wanting to hurt people. But, you know, when you're entrusted and, you know, put in a position to do your job, and he said some, you know, you never know what you're going to come across, right? And it makes it very, very hard. But I think, you know, a lot of the chaos that ensued there, you know, and like I said, I'm not into all the science and understanding of the whys and the hows and the whats, what was going on there. But I feel like the community bank at that point was empty on law enforcement as a whole. And it took traction. And like I said, everything else started off from there. And, you know, there could have been more positive deposits put into the bank, and there wasn't that way. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Someone said to me recently, water boils at 212 degrees and a lot of people are walking around at 210. That's the perfect analogy. All it took was that straw to break the camel's back.
Yep. And I agree with that. I mean, it makes perfect sense, right? Because like I said, is, you know, you can only withdraw so much, right, before you have a problem. And like I said, if a bank goes bankrupt, what happens? Or what happens when your bank account goes empty, right? You don't have it no more, right? So what do you start doing? You start freaking out. Well, if the community is out of money, in a sense, right, and community relations and how you treat the people and, you know, everything like that, well, if enough's enough, and they're going to throw their hands, and it's going to be a problem. So
when you entered the law enforcement agency here in the US, you know, what was your experience at the front door? What were the fitness standards? Was there any mental health conversation? What was the kind of environment that you walked into?
There was a basic mental health examination to get in, but there was no real mental health. I mean, as far as like mental health on the cop side, you know, we can, you know, you can talk about that. There was, you know, resilience was not a thing. There was no conversations about, you know, you either sucked up and you pressed on, you keep moving forward, you shut up and colored, you did whatever you had to do to get through it. The police academy alone, you know, it was, you know, like I said, a good mix of education and experience, but a lot of discipline and, you know, a lot of grit and, you know, just rolling around in the grass and the dirt and, you know, push-ups, sit-ups, run, you know, the hazing, whatever they wanted to do. And the instructors were young instructors at the time, and they weren't that far out of the police academy from where I was at, right? Just a couple of years out, and they were now instructors. And like I said, you took your beatings as they took it, and you said you get through it. And that was 6 months of, you know, just straight, you know, chaos in the police academy. And you're trying to learn all your laws and everything else you got to, you know, to get to and understand the grasp of things, right? And then you come out and you're dropped in the FTO, which is a completely different animal from the police academy, because now there's not the yelling and screaming, but now you have to perform, right? And you have to show up to work every day and be the best you can. And you're making mistakes. And at the time, we, you know, there was no, not that it's that long ago, but almost 18 years ago, we were still handwriting reports out, and you would bang a report out by hand, and you take it to your FTO, you look at it, crinkle it up, throw it in a trash can, you'd have to rewrite it again. So, you know, that was the learning style. You could never do that today. You crinkle up a young kid's paper today, man, it'd be a heart attack, you know? But the times were just different, right? So we navigated that. And like I said, getting into the spaces, you know, you were call to call and 12 hours a day, and my agency, while we're small, we're averaging anywhere from 25,000 to 27,000 calls a year. That's a lot, you know, over the course of a 3-point square mile town, you know. So you're humping it and you're working hard, you know.
Again, you come out of high school and you enter, you know, pre-hospital medicine, you know, and you get this one lens. Now you've been in the military and the law enforcement side, and you enter your department here. What were some of the kind of jarring moments or aha moments about the difference between what you've been doing in the military and what you were doing here in the US?
Well, military law enforcement is different because, you know, obviously military have, you know, there's at least a standard set in the military where you have a baseline, right? The civilian side is you never know what you're walking into. People only ever call you they don't call you to say hello. They only ever call you when they need you, right? So you're showing up at their worst moment of their time in their life. And, you know, the military coming out of that space, you know, as a young cop in the Air Force, it was very strict. You're challenging people on the flight line, you're pointing guns at them, put them on the ground, challenge them, you know, get them off the flight line, searching them, you know, interrogate them, figuring out what's going on and why they're there and whatnot. And then you go to the police world, you can't follow those same rules. And, you know, while early in my career, it was a lot of that kind of stuff was similar in a sense. But, you know, I tell you that I learned only really to how to talk to people is when I became a detective. And, you know, when I transitioned into the detective world about 6 years into my career, and, you know, it wasn't until then where I realized how much communication, just being able to empathize with people, really made a difference, you know. So I feel like that was something that, you know, was kind of lacking at the point, which, you know, is very well, you know, very, you know, sought now. And, you know, guys are very much told how to communicate. And, you know, we'll average 30 to 50 minutes on a call with people now versus just, you know, hammer them out and just go to the next, right? Because that's all we had. But, you know, you're forever shifting gears. You know, you start out with grandma that fell down her steps to somebody dead on an overdose, or you shift the gear to a really bad car crash, or you're dealing with CPR on a child. Like, you never know what you're going to walk into. And you said those 40 to 60 calls you're answering in a shift is a lot, you know.
One of the big things about the recruitment crisis in the fire side is, you know, they work, I think Northeast, they have quite a few departments that work 42-hour work weeks, but most of the country is working 56, so 24, 48. And, you know, when I came on, you weren't questioning work weeks. You were just, you know, all kind of starry-eyed and wanting to be a firefighter, and it's an admirable pursuit. But as you mentioned, the core loads a lot of our agencies have, not to mention the mandatory overtime, because we have this recruitment crisis now, is creating these insane work weeks. And, you know, in the fire side, I think what's happening is a lot of these young people, do value their physical health, their mental health, their time with family, and they're looking at the black and white, you know, what it looks like to be a firefighter and the divorces and the cancers and all the things, and going, that doesn't look very attractive. And I totally understand. I think that's a very intelligent way of looking at it. What is it with the law enforcement side that you think has caused this shift from testing against hundreds, if not thousands of people, to 5 applications?
Well, I think I said again, like it's you know, the world politics, I think, drives a big thing is, you know, you're set for an example for others, right? If you do one thing wrong, you're going to be the next figurehead on TV, right? Being, you know, blasted for doing something wrong. But also, too, is like, you know, we've seen it with some of our younger guys that we've hired where they'll go through the police academy, embrace all the suck that they could ever have for that 6 months. And they'll get into field training and they start dealing with the public and they immediately are pumping the brakes and saying, whoa, I didn't sign up for this. And that's, well, what did you expect it to do? And, you know, whether we're failing to articulate it properly in the police academy was still old style mindset of training and not articulating enough, you know, where we are to what we're dealing with on the street, right? Or is it, you know, when I get on a shift work, because the academy is Monday through Friday, you know, 8 to 4, right? Or 8 to 5, 7 to 5, whatever it comes out to be, right? And then you come to shift work and now you're working days and nights, you know, 12-hour shifts. You know, you're locked into a shift. You know, some agencies switch weekly, some agencies switch 3 months, you know, but they hit these 12-hour shifts and that's a lot of time away from home and you're missing holidays and then you start experiencing, you know, especially as a younger kid, right? Like some kids are just starting families. Now, what's the pressure at home they're getting, you know, and they're coming home telling them about, oh my God, I stood at a dead body for 4 hours because I was waiting for the detectives to finish up. And then I had to go deal, you know, and then my boss was pissed because I didn't get my reports done, you know, so they take a beating because of the expectations. But, you know, are we not setting them up for success in the academy early on, you know, to get them to roll into where they are today?
Do you think the fact that they have been raised in an electronic age is also setting them up for failure when it comes to simply interacting? Because I see even, you know, young people that are holding down jobs and being successful, but even you can just see the ability to maintain eye contact, the ability to have a conversation just doesn't seem the same as it was when I was a teen, for
right.
example.
Right. If I'm sitting here having a conversation and we're talking and I'm looking at my phone the whole time and I'm not paying any attention to you, I mean, how effective is that going to be, right? But, you know, with the addictiveness of these phones and the time that we spend on them and the amount of space that we live in those space, I mean, it's there, right? It's there's a dopamine effect to these things, you know, where you get sucked into them and you can't put them down, right? And, you know, whether you're sitting on Instagram or TikTok or whatever, the blue sky is the new Twitter that's coming out now, you know, all these new fancy, you know, social media platforms that are popping up. But what's, you know, they draw you in for, just like you said earlier, right? The clickbait and everything else you want to do. And, you know, my wife has recently found on Instagram that they have these really, really bad acting short stories on Instagram. And she loves to watch them. And they draw you in, but they hit you with a small fee and you watch them and it goes from there. You know? So it's very hard because majority of their time is spent looking at this. They don't know how to communicate with anybody because even going to see my little guy in first, you know, in school when I was there, you know, they're pecking away at the computer. The teacher says, all right, well, click this button and go to this exercise and do this. And she just sits and watches them. Like, are we really educating our kids or are we letting somebody else do it via a means of a computer?
Yeah. Well, I think especially in our field, you know, whether it's doing an assessment, you know, as a paramedic or whether it's trying to de-escalate a situation as a police officer, you're not just having to communicate, you're having to communicate in a potentially life or death situation. So by, you know, by restricting their ability to communicate, and again, this is not blaming any one particular entity, but this environment that these kids have been grown up in, especially adding in the freaking pandemic for these poor kids as well, you know, it's a very, very dangerous thing to then put them in and say, oh yeah, now you got to learn how to talk. And by the way, that person might shoot you if you get it wrong. So, you know, it really is an important conversation if we're going to set the next kind of generation of recruits up for success.
And I agree with you. I think that, you know, we have to do a better job, right? And it's on us, you know, as the current, you know, workers in the space is to, you know, continually evolve and educate ourselves to find the better, right? Scott Sonnen just put an article out. I don't know if you saw my post about it on LinkedIn, but He posted something the other day about the readiness, you know, the statures of readiness over the course of time. And so I pulled up real quick. I can tell you the but I thought it was very well written. And I was telling I sent a message just saying, hey, it was, you know, a great article there, because I felt like it hit a lot of important parts, because it was talking more about the military side of things. But the, his whole article was the evolution of human performance training, navigating the geopolitical paradigm shifts. And then when you go into it, it just basically goes through the years of, you know, 2001 to 2008 was lethality. 2008 to 2016 was recovery, right? 2016 to 2020 was readiness and, you know, the preparedness and just trying to be ready for what's to come. And 2020 to 2024 was resiliency, right? Why is it resiliency? We all know that, right? Because we're in the isolation era of the COVID. And then we're expected, you know, one, our kids were expected to embrace that, not knowing any idea what's going on. But then, two, we're experiencing it, nothing that we've ever experienced before. So the isolation era really put a damper on things. And now 2024 to forward is the cognitive overmatch, which he talks about integrating advanced technologies, decision-making under pressure, multi-domain operational skills. Like, those are the things that we need to start looking at. And I think he really nailed the head on the article with the fact that we have to continue to evolve, but we need to be more in tune with what's going on ultimately. You know what I mean? With training our folks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I've had this conversation with a couple of people recently. It really struck me not too long ago that when we're talking about physical and mental health, realistically, we're talking about stopping our police officers and firefighters from dying. We're not talking about human performance. There's not really anything that we do that's, you know, in the weight room trying to forge, you know, an Uber athlete in the fire service. I'm not talking about some sporting level, but making them physically better, making their breath work better, making their mindset better. We're just saying, hey, let's try and stop them from killing themselves. Let's try and get them less obese. And I feel like this conversation has devolved to the point, and I know this is because I've seen it with my own eyes, you know, a strength and conditioning expert will come to a fire department and they'll teach him how to make oatmeal and walk around the station twice. And we couldn't be further from the demands of a firefighter in a worst case scenario. So I think that's a huge red flag, is that if our human performance conversation, air quotes, is simply about mitigating the insane illnesses and deaths, then we have to kind of recalibrate where we should be, get our people back to baseline, and then go beyond. Because, you know, we are supposed to be there on people's worst day. So you need a fit, you know, injury-free or limited injury, calm thinking, well-rested first responder to be there on your family's worst day.
100%. I always say too, is like you can't build a structure without a solid foundation, right? So if your foundation is not solid, and if you don't have, you know, if you have an inch thick of concrete versus 2 feet of concrete, what's your difference, right? A lot, right? Structure. So if you can't build the foundation early, and even if you had to revert it back to re-education and, you know, re-experience, like, you're never going to take away all the experiences, but you can build a stronger foundation by, you know, fixing what's there. And then each pillar, you know, of wellness, or, you know, however you want to performance, or however you want to look at it, you know, can then be sought upon. But, you know, you try to put that stuff into the academies early on when it comes like to the resilience front, right? Like in New Jersey here, we have the mandatory resilience training that, you know, came out in 2019. And the, you know, everybody is mandated to take it, but, you know, it couldn't happen at a better time, you know, prior to the COVID era, right? Because, you know, when everybody was isolated, you had the resources and tools that, you know, were somewhat available to take you from baseline and put you at a higher accession line, so that way you can ride here, so that when you do fall, and we still are in crisis, right? Like, there's no question that, you know, there's not, you know, but we need to do a better job. And I, you know, I'm a huge advocate for it, as you can see from my postings, and, you know, because I experienced struggle myself, right? And, you know, as you go through and navigate these things, is you have to ultimately seek hard to find the stuff to make you better, you know?
Absolutely. When you reflect back on your career, what are some of the, what we would call career calls that you've had?
Man, so we've had, you call it frog when people, you know, are crossing the highway, and, you know, it's, you know, reminds you of the old game Frogger, where they're trying to jump lily pad to lily pad and they get hit by a car, and, you know, they get annihilated. And that's, you know, something in, you know, our small town that we deal with regularly, unfortunately, is that, you know, people are crossing the highway, they don't pay attention, or it's dark, or they're not dressed appropriately, and they get annihilated. by a car and they're killed, and you come up to a scene and, you know, they're all the way down the highway, and you now you have to come and, you know, seeing that as a young police officer, you know, is hard at one, but then the harder part is going and have to tell the families, right? And before we started our chaplain service, you know, it was two officers, and we had to go wrap on the first, find out where they lived, and then go knock on their door and let them know that their loved one had passed. And, you know, that really leaves a profound impact on you, because it's hard, right? And, you know, to experience tragedy, you know, on the opposite end of the receiving end, right, is almost as hard as probably receiving it, right? Because what do you do for a family that, one, you don't even know, but then two, you're trying to articulate how the whys and everything else, because there's 1,000 questions, but then also to watch them literally fall to their knees and, you know, praying to God or whoever they believe in, that the fact that their loved one's no longer here, you know? So that has made a huge impact, you know, being able to do that. And, you know, and it's definitely over the time you become numb to it. But then, you know, dealing with, especially now as a detective, you know, you see all the bad, right? So, you know, you're showing up to the dead bodies, you're showing up to the real bad assaults, and, you know, seeing the different things that way. And, you know, I can remember at one point in my career is, and I know it left a profound impact on a friend of mine, but, you know, and it's still, I can talk about it to this day, because we talk about it regularly, because the little girl's a vegetable, but it was a child abuse case, and the guy wound up smashing this girl's head into the wall and, you know, shifted her brain. And it's like, you know, now she's a vegetable, but, you know, we saw her at 2. This is probably 10 years ago. So now she's 12, but she's still a vegetable. You know what I mean? Like, it's sad, you know, but then the guy, you know, doesn't, I mean, he was wrong, or he didn't get what he was supposed to get. You know what I mean? Like, the court's failure, however you want to look at it, but those things leave lasting impressions in your mind, and, you know, they never really disappear, right? Same with the homicides. You get out there and you deal with homicides, and we're not a bad town, but we've had our share of homicides, whether it's one or two a year to up to 4 a year, right? And same thing is you go there and you're doing the work to try to figure out the who, the what, the when, the where, the why, the how, and, you know, trying to dig through all this mess and, you know, having to relive the experience for these people, for them to get to where you need to be ultimately, right? And some motives you can understand, some motives you just never will understand, you know?
How much of the death and destruction that you've had to witness do you think is down to the national mental health crisis that a lot of people seem to be intent on ignoring?
Man, I mean, we are in a mental health crisis, no doubt about it. And like I said, I feel like, you know, it's very, very hard, because drugs are at an all-time high, you know, and drugs have been an all-time high for several years, right? So the families that were users then, now their kids are coming back, right? And that does have a ripple effect to it, right? So, like, there is a major problem with it. I feel like we're slowly doing a better job at managing the mental health, but we still don't have the mental health support in the courts and everything else that you needed to be in, right, to really get that effect out to the public, right? Because like I said, it still costs money. You still need to have insurance. You still need to be able to, because, you know, insurance is only going to cover you what they want. They'll take all your money, but they ain't never going to give it to you. So those that are struggling, you know, they're always going to struggle, because they just throw medicine at it. And like I said, when you don't treat it appropriately, it's all manageable for the most part. You know, obviously there's things that you can't, but, you know, when you just throw medicine at things, it's a suppressant. It's not something that's going to fix, you know, the end all be all. And kind of like drugs, right? We have drug court in New Jersey, and, you know, people use drugs and they go into the drug court and then they get kicked loose. They get clean drug tests and, you know, follow the rules for X amount of time. Then they relapse and then it happens again. It's just the cyclical nature of it. And it's unfortunate, you know, drugs today are just chemicals. They're not even natural drugs like they were back in the day, coming out of the poppy fields or, you know, out of the cocoa plant, right? Like, they're all, you know, xylazine and all these other chemicals they're just chemicals pumping into your body. And, you know, they just do so much damaging effects, and it doesn't create a healthy mind. But then their minds are bad, but then the families are put through so much that their minds start to get touted, right? And then it's the ripple effect outward, you know? So I feel like it's a problem, you know what I mean? But there are things that they're trying to do, and I know that there are some good people trying to do it. You just need to get a lot of the more powerful people behind it to say, hey, you know, this is what we got to do, you know?
I think this is what's really unfair with the, you know, law enforcement conversation is they're constantly looking at you to mitigate the things. And if you're too rough, then, you know, you're demonized and, you know, why do you look like you're going to war? What's with all the body armor? But no one's ever saying, why are the streets of America so dangerous? What have we done in this country that's created so much homelessness that our children, just like my son did the other day, have these code reds where they assume that someone's going to walk into their classroom and execute them all, that we have gangs. You look at other parts of the country, some are just as bad, other parts of the world, but there's a lot of countries that are a lot safer than we are. And I think this is the element, is if we're not addressing this multi-generational trauma that's creating this violence and this mental ill health, and we're just putting it on law enforcement's shoulder, nothing's going to change. It's just going to get worse and worse.
And exactly the truth. Like New Jersey is a sanctuary state, and whether, you know, you want to believe in it or not, I mean, I leave my opinion where it's to be left, but, you know, there are things that are in play for that. And like I said, you know, to kick every illegal in this country out is not the way to go about things, right? Like, you can't just do that. It's a cost that's never anybody's ever going to achieve, right? But there are a lot of bad people that are locked up or there are pending extraditions out of the country that they need to focus upon to get them out of here, right? But then you start looking at, like you said, the active shooter things, right? When's the last time a school's burnt down? You know, and this is what something I talk about, right? In your fire service career, when can you tell the last person or last time a school's burnt down, right?
Yeah, well, apparently it was the 50s when they had a multi-facility, yeah.
Right, the 50s. But that's the last time we can ever articulate a fire, but we still practice fire drills, right? But then when it comes to active shooters, right, we can't put our kids through it because it's too hard on their minds, right? And I understand it to a point. Like, you can sensitize it and make it what it is, but just practicing the safety hazard, but to see something, say, so whatever you want to look at, however, you know, whatever program you want to talk about, you know, that's out there. But like I said, you know, it is scary. And like I said, our young kids are having to face these, and, you know, you have to have the conversations early so that they're prepared, right? And then, you know, you talk about, you know, looking at what's happening with these gangs and stuff that are taking over these apartment complexes and different things like that. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of bad things happening, but, you know, we're in a recruiting crisis, so people aren't jumping across the table to become a cop, right? So it's almost like, what do we do at this point now? And, you know, the old timers are starting to wear down. And, you know, as they get older in their career, are they going to be wanting to fight the same fights that the young kids are going to want to fight? And it's not that way, you know?
If you were king for a day, what would be the elements that you would change so that you could get back to 20 years ago, but obviously, you know, with the technology and advances of 2024, how do we get back to the point where people are lining up to be police officers again?
Right. I think that if we kind of, like what I was saying with that article that I was talking about, is if we can take a new approach to building a better foundation of human performance, ultimately, in a sense, right? And giving all the tools and resources that you need and making it something that, you know, it's not all bad. Like I said, you're going to experience that, right? There's never going to get away from it. But if you had to revert it back to what it's something that's worth its space to bring more people on board, is one, you got to make it something that they're going to want to come back to, right? Like, you know, what drew them in then that's not drawing them in now, right? Are there not enough police videos on YouTube and, you know, that are positive versus just shootings? And, you know, because that's a lot of that stuff that is, right? How many taser deployments or, you know, shootings are out there on the internet that everybody wants to watch over and over again? Well, you know, you could find them all day, but some young kids, like, I'm not going to go to do that because I'm not going to get involved in that, you know? So is it trying to find a space that, you know, you bring more into the trade space, like you talked about with the technical schools, was, you know, and the kids are growing and they evolve into a space that's built that way. You know what I mean? Whether it's any responder space, you know, I'd say it's first, second, third responders. It doesn't really matter. You're all responders, right? Whether you're nurses, doctors, fire, EMS, police, you're all responding somewhere to do something that normal people aren't going to do, right? So we find whatever responder space we got and, you know, however you're going to train them, but you can start early, you know, in a sense where I started my career, you know, and find those that are going to enjoy it and then teach them the right way, you know, to build that foundation. I think that's what you bring back, you know, especially on the human performance front, is, you know, there's a lot of pieces that go into it, you know, mind, body, spirit, you know, all that kind of stuff is there. And a lot of it, which is, we don't get that anymore.
I had Sebastian Junger on the show several times, and one of the conversations he talked about wanting to bring in national service, and he said it doesn't have to be military, but a year where you are serving your country in some capacity. And again, you could be working in veterinary surgery, you could be, you know, volunteering as a firefighter or whatever the thing is. But now, you know, it's kind of like the Israeli model. I know there's they're not exactly glowing with their leadership choices at the moment, but with their military, their whole ethos is that they have a buddy system and they are watching their buddy's ass and their buddy is watching their ass. So when you are in an organization where you understand, you know, the importance of being in a community, the importance of service, and what your the impact that your actions have on your nation, I think, you know, generationally, we would probably go back to, you know, the quote unquote good old days. But at the moment, you know, with people who are really putting their lives on the line being demonized while people just sit there on their cell phone, you know, keyboard warrioring, there's no skin in the game. And I really like that idea of everyone having to serve for a year.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, right? Because it, one, you're going to find out some may just never have even had the thought of even trying to do it, right? So they now you're put into a position where they have to do it, right? And you experience, and you may find it would be something you enjoyed, right? Like, I never thought I was going to be a cop one day. I never thought I was going to be in the military one day. But, you know, I stepped outside the box to where it is. And, you know, here I am. And, you know, I said it's something, you know, it's still a noble profession. It's just we're struggling. And like I said, it's very, very hard, you know, especially on our guys on our shifts. You know it in the fire service as well. Like, people aren't knocking the doors down. So your guys are constantly at minimums. They're working overtime. They're never getting a break from the day to day. And, you know, I said, you spend more time at work ultimately now than you do with your families.
What really nauseates me is when the papers will do an article and it will say, oh, this firefighter made this much money. This is how much they're getting paid. They're not telling them they work 56 hours a week, plus they were forced to be, you know, every 2 weeks forced to do an 80-hour week. That's never in the conversation. So it looks like, oh, wow, they made that much money. Yeah, well, you would make that much money if you worked 80
hours. And not to mention, they usually look at gross pay and they'll advertise the gross pay versus your net pay. And we all know that's a huge difference, right? So, you know, what shows on paper is not what I'm bringing home every day. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, you touched on, you know, obviously some of the traumatic elements of the job. What have been your kind of mental health highs and lows throughout your career?
Man, so, you know, I know you've talked about this many, many, many times in the past is, you know, we look at, you know, we started with our families, right? The adverse childhood experiences, the experience growing up. And, you know, one thing I don't mention about my, you know, dad and stand-up guy that he was, but he suffered from alcoholism. And, you know, that was a very, very hard piece to deal with, right? My mom was a heavy hand growing up because that's how she was raised. And, you know, having, you know, family members that, you know, treat you in that aspect is hard, right? So then you kind of get away from it and you move into the military space where now you're, you know, yelling, screaming, hooting, hollering, discipline is a thing. And then you grow up and then you start experiencing different things, you know, whether it's in a deployed environment or it's something you experience, you know, at home, not at home, but like in the police world, right? You meet everybody at their worst day, right? So those things all compound and then the trauma just kind of builds. And, you know, whether you want to call it trauma or terrible experiences, they all kind of have a piece and it's, you know, nicks at your armor, right? And the vicarious trauma that happens over the course of your career, you know, starting from a very young age, because we come out this perfect little baby, right? And then you're thrown out to the world and, you know, going from there. So, I suffered a little bit, you know, with my dad being an alcoholic. And then, you know, thank God he's recovered from that. And, you know, God bless his soul. And I said, that's, you know, something that's huge at this point, right? But then I said, you got a mom that's a heavy hand and, you know, probably some mental health issues. I couldn't tell you. I'm not a doctor, right? But, you know, growing up and then, like I said, with the police world, it's tough, like I said, because you meet everybody at their worst. Nobody ever calls you to say hello. They'll drop cookies off at Christmas time, but that's about the only time, you know, somebody's calling you. Because what do people do? They call you when they're at their worst, right? So you get there, you deal with whatever you got to deal with, and you're expected to go to the next 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 calls, whatever you got to deal with in a shift, you know, and they all could be bad the whole day. You never know, right? And then, so for me, one thing we did, we had, obviously the state of New Jersey brought out the resilience program. But early in the military career is you got the, you know, the Air Force has comprehensive airman fitness, you know, the Army has the Army, the model for resilience, you know, whatnot. And that was a lot of that was implicated, you know, or started back in what 2008, 2009 timeframe through the University of Penn. So we called up University of Penn to try to get something started for New Jersey. New Jersey kicked off the resilience program in 2019. Which was just a baseline foundational program for wellness. And then some other folks, you know, in that space, they wound up retiring from law enforcement and created a program. for resilience. And I, you know, wound up going through that and experiencing that and started to be a facilitator for them just because I found out how important it was. All during that time is, you know, and, you know, where the struggle for me and a little bit of it comes into play is, you know, with all that experience prior with, you know, the family and whatnot is, you know, learning, you know, from minor health issues, cholesterol issues that I discovered that my dad that raised me was not my dad, you know, biologically. And, you know, when I discovered that, it kind of puts you in a spiral, right? Because you're like, you can what if that all day long, right? And trying to figure that space. And, you know, it kind of put me down a little bit. And then to the point where I was struggling, I had a couple dark days and, you know, a couple times where I just didn't know what end was going to be up, right? And, you know, you just didn't know how to navigate it. And he said, we were immersed into my career and, you know, said, you know, on the detective side, you're experiencing a lot of the negative. And with the DNA finding, it was kind of like, whoa, what's this mystery now? You know what I mean? And where did this all come from? Because, you know, your mom and dad are raising you all day long to tell you to do the right thing and never do anything wrong. And then all of a sudden you're told, hey, wait, your mom screwed up. And it's been a lifelong secret of yours at age 40, you find out, right? So I wound up found initially I had taken a class with Tom Spooner and some of his team from Northern Red. And he had talked about a program called Warrior's Heart, and it kind of left a lasting impression, which is that was more for substance abuse and, you know, for military veterans. And, you know, so I found out that I was struggling after several iterations of resilience training. And then I wound up going, I called Warrior Heart just saying, hey, listen, I'm struggling. I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know where I'm going to be tomorrow. I don't know what's going to be happening. Like, the world's chaotic. Like, my mind's chaotic. Like, I need help, right? So I found this. So they referred me to a program called Warrior Path, which is through the Boulder Crest Foundation. I don't know if you're familiar with them at all.
I have heard nothing but good things about Boulder Crest over and over again.
And James, when I tell you, brother, like that program saved my life. Like when I talk about, you know, and like I said, I wasn't on the end of demise like some other folks, you know, have been. And like I said, I've been to a dark place and, you know, experienced the, you know, the what ifs, right? But when we look at it, and I spent the week in Boulder Crest with the Warrior Path family that I got to meet and now cherish, you know, to this day, like, you know, man, it changed my life, you know, forever, right? And like, so, because I would sit out front and cry, I'd be upset, I'd be angry, you know, and just didn't, the wave of emotions were there. But once I was able to go to Boulder Crest and Warrior Path, I tell you what, man, it changed my life forever. And, you know, at that point, it made me realize, like, we have to do better, right? And you know, I said, you learn little pieces over the course of your lifetime, but those little pieces over the course of your lifetime, you know, you learn to figure out, you know, these are the things that I need to do. And that's my new mission, right? Is now just to spread the word and you really just give it back to what Boulder Crest gave me in the very little bit that I can do, right? And, you know, my whole sole goal is to give somebody a better foundation than I was given. You know what I mean?
What was it about that program? What were the tools that were given to you that allowed you to start working through some of these struggles?
Right. So mindfulness obviously is huge. Breathing is huge. Journaling, just meditation, just giving back a little bit of time for yourself, exercise, movement, you know, fresh air, like just the basic things that live and surround us on a daily basis, right? Are the things that we forget about, right? It's almost like I became a cop. I'm now the cop, right? I'm the what, right? But I forget the who am I, right? And we forget who that is at that point, right? Because we don't, you know, we become so much in tune with that space that we don't realize what we are. And like I said, having the ability to meditate, like I'm not a guy that's going to sit there and, you know, meditate, but just to sit down and be quiet for 20 minutes is very powerful, right? Just like I say, a 20 minute nap will say, you know, is great, right? But for that, like 20 minutes of meditation, you know, doing some breathing exercises, 4-7-8 breathing, box breathing, whatever you want to get into, right? Taking that time for yourself just to kind of slow things down and know that, you know, put your body back at rest is huge. And that's something that I had since lost at that point, you know?
You mentioned ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences score. It's amazing how we don't talk about from birth or even, you know, in vitro through to when we put the uniform on. We do a box checking ridiculous psych test that all the psychologists and psychiatrists have had on have said was never meant to be you know, a standalone test to show if you have the right kind of profile to be a cop or a paramedic or a firefighter. But those, you know, those formative years are so important. And then obviously understanding the generations prior to that too. So what did you do as far as processing the early life? And did you discover that there was even, you know, like grandparents' generation, that there were struggles, that maybe these dominoes kept falling?
Yeah, and that was part of Bouldercrest, is you had a lot of time to kind of really dig and search, right? And while it's only a short, you know, 7-day program in the present, right? Each day was just jam-packed, and you said your brain literally hurt when you were finished, but it hurt for the good in a sense, because you were working it to a point where you were able to have an experience and work through the experience with like-minded folks around you, and you're safe, right? And ultimately, instead of having to be hyper-vigilant and constantly looking over, like, you're in a very serene, safe place that you have nothing to worry about, right? And you can be vulnerable. And I think that being vulnerable is a huge tool, right? Because if you can allow the vulnerability to kick in for yourself, it really makes a difference, because the vulnerability will allow, one, for yourself, but for others to grasp upon and to see. So with that, is they have some exercises that we did during the program, and you would basically, in different colors, write the good and the bad of each thing. And you would talk about it and say, this is the things, like, you know, dad was an alcoholic, mom would beat the shit out of you, dad would, had, like, it was super hard on discipline, or, you know, grandpa was this, and, you know, so you would list the goods and the bads, and you have it, but you would find that your list was more red than blue, right? So, and the red meaning bad. And it, like, you'd be like, oh my God, like, is this really true? And then you would go back and try to think about it, and all the stuff that you're talking about was like, man. So then you would talk about it and do some exercises that come along with it, part of the program. And, you know, you don't want to give it all away, but, you know, it's, you know, things that you do while you're there, and, you know, really makes you dig deep to find those pieces, right, that we're missing. And those are the things that you kind of block off in a different part of your brain, and they loom in there when you start getting angry and frustrated and want to experience things. But, you know, on the everyday, they you know, they're there, but they're kind of just gnawing away, you know, where you don't really realize it, you know.
Talk to me about where you are now, because I think one of the things, I've said this a lot recently on the mental health conversation, especially in first responders, is we've got our pant legs stuck on stigma. Like, we're just still there. Smash the stigma is all you hear. I'm here for you. You know, call this number. And there's no actual hope instilled in the post-traumatic growth, in what happens when you work through these struggles. And you hear so many times of people that they've literally become a beacon of light for others. People come out the woodwork and, like, I've been struggling too. And it was their journey that inspired them to then, you know, speak out themselves. So what have you seen within yourself as far as that post-traumatic growth side?
Well, right. And I could tell you that I feel like, you know, one, you know, using social media as a positive, right, and share, you know, the experiences that you have, right, whether we're having a conversation now and talking about it, like, the DNA thing's a high priority thing, right, because you never expect to find what you're going to find. And if you're going to do those silly tests, you're going to do it. And like I said, my journey on that space was to find out what was going on with me inside of my body, not for the whole, because 23andMe gives you the raw DNA data versus, so then you can put it into a program to find out what's wrong. Never expecting to find out that I was going to find that out, right? So, you know, when it comes to working through this stuff and the post-traumatic growth pieces, you know, I feel like sharing a story is powerful, right? Is just alone is allowing, you know, yourself, right? It's like apologies are meant for you, not for other people, right? So you go to apologize for somebody or to forgive somebody, your forgiveness is for you, not for them. Whether they think it is or not, it doesn't really matter, right? But you still feel better for, you know, relieving that. Why? Because you're talking about it. You're not letting it sit in the rucksack that's filled with rocks of all of these traumas and everything else that's built in there, right? So if you can unpack the rocks to allow more space for more bad to fit in there, you know what I mean? You have a better chance of growth, right? And you're not weighed down by the burden that lives within it, because once you talk about it, your terrible experience is not really a thought anymore, because you've just relieved that pressure in a sense, right? So, you know, you're not going to go into a fire without pressure testing your bottle, right? And putting it on your back. So, you know, having that, you knowing that it's going to work and go forward, but having a conversation, like I said, and sharing the story with others, you know, and saying, hey man, like, I'm here for you. Like, there's nothing wrong with being vulnerable, and there's nothing wrong with showing a side of you that, you know, is in a sense sensitive, right? Because it, sometimes people need to see that, because the hard facade that you can show in the front, if you can show them what you're really about, it's kind of the who and the what, right? The what of me is not going to allow me to conversate, but the who of me would allow me to talk about that all day long, right? But if you continue to share that and show people that you have the ability to do it, then that just, it's almost, what is it? It spreads, right? It's, you know, it allows people to, you know, want to embrace that a little bit. And while some are harder to penetrate than others, is having those conversations that are more positive versus negative, you know, allows for these folks to get a better show, you know?
I've used this analogy loads of times now, but it's the yin and the yang. You know, I always tell people it was the soft, compassionate black. I think it's, I don't know why I can never remember which is which, but I think it's yang. That sends us into uniform. The whether it's coming from trauma and you don't want other people to be hurt the way you were or whatever the thing is, it's a very selfless act to go and, you know, go leave your family and go and protect complete strangers. And then as we progress through the career, especially if you were raised in our generation with Stallones and Rambos and these kind of stone-faced bodybuilders as your example of masculinity, you know, you now you become a white circle and you've lost the very thing that actually sent you into uniform. And so now you believe that, you know, speaking about mental health is being a pussy and it's weakness, and we've got it completely backwards. It's courage that takes you to be vulnerable. That's a brave thing to say, I need some help. So I think reframing this and getting people to check back in and realizing that we've got it completely twisted. And if you are, you know, thinking that everyone's okay and, you know, you're just going to keep it to yourself, you're going to bury it down, that's the opposite of what a courageous man or woman will do. A courageous man or woman, if they're struggling, will ask for help. And I think if we can frame that back as the brave thing to do, we are a brave community. So hopefully then it will get people realizing that, oh, so it's okay for me to ask for help, because that's the very kindness and compassion that I would show anyone else in uniform if I knew they were struggling.
And I feel like that relates to a lot of different things, right? Whether it's our own people, whether it's our families, whether it's the people we encounter in the street, right? Is being vulnerable to a point where you empathize and can put yourself in their shoes under their same circumstances. Take yourself and you empathize with that space and say, hey, man, like, I can relate. I may not understand all the ins and outs of it, right? But if you can empathize with them and put themselves in the same shoes on the same circumstances, how much of a better person are you going to be to give it back to them, you know, when you have to deal with them? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, I want to hit one more topic and then we'll go to some closing questions. But while we're on the topic of courage, I've been doing this now for 8 years. And 8 years ago in the fire service, I was talking, you know, not only about the mental health side, but also, you know, the insanity of the way that we work our firefighters. Because, I mean, the mandatory overtime has been there for a long, long time. And again, I'm totally fine with mandatory overtime when we have a hurricane or something that's worthy of an all hands event, but not as a staffing model unending. And we've seen this decline now. And the beautiful thing about this recruitment crisis is we really have to act, because it's going to go one of two ways. You're either going to turn the ship around, or your town or city is not going to have a fire department anymore or a police department. You know, and do you want to be the fire chief or police chief or, you know, council member that, you know, sank the ship for your community? So, but where I struggle with is when I was in fire academy, any cowardice would have, you know, meant I would be thrown out of the fire academy. If I didn't climb the ladder, if I didn't go into the burning building, if I didn't go off the edge on a rope, then you can't be a firefighter. Fast forward 20 years, and I'm seeing a lot of cowardice when it comes to leadership. And the reason I say that is, you know, you have people who have lost numerous people in their department that, you know, they're training people, and then within 2 or 3 years, they're walking out the back door. And the answers are all there. The solutions are all there, but it takes courage to go to your city, your county, your board members, whoever it is, and say, this needs to change. We are losing our people. We are losing people as far as recruitment. You know, we are at a crisis. So for me, I feel like 2025 needs to be the year of courage, not only on the mental health, but on the leadership side too. And calling out cowardice. If someone is refusing to actually step up and advocate for their people, then getting them to step aside and letting someone with a set of balls do the job for them. So what is your kind of perspective on courage / cowardice in leadership in our professions, plural?
Well, right. And I see, you know, across, you know, my time in the military and the police world, and not so much, you know, from my place, you know, but, and there, it happens a little bit, but, you know, I feel like there's a lot of managers, not a lot of leaders, right? And, you know, whether you're the highly most educated guy there and you're going to be the leader, but you could be the manager, or you could be the most experienced guy and have the most experience and be a leader, but not a manager. Like, so there's no real fine line. And, you know, I know, you know, there's there's a lot of training, and going back to the education experience, right, is experience is good, but like you can't be afraid to call it out, right? And you know, you have to be a voice for those that aren't ever going to speak up, right? And managers won't speak up. They'll speak up when they can because it's easy, right? But they won't speak up when they have to, when it's not easy, right? So if we step up as the leaders in our space, you know, showing that, hey, we're not afraid to take it on by the head, and we're not afraid to go in first, you know, without questions asked, right? And you're doing it for the right reasons, and you're doing it, then yes, that's exactly it. 2025 needs to be a time of courage, right? Because we are in a very, very strange place right now in the world, as we all know. And, you know, there is a lot of cowardice in the world right now, and it's not easy to see. It's not hard to see. But we want to make sure that we're stepping with the right foot forward. And, you know, as long as we can articulate it in for the right reasons and for the right timing in the right space, then listen, the world needs good leaders, right? As well as even on the local level, from the highest to the lowest, you need to have a leader, right? You need to be a leader as a father. You need to be a leader as a husband. You need to be, or a wife. You know what I mean? Like, this is all stuff that needs to be transformative. And like I say, with the growth part of it, like, you have to be able to step in and stabilize when it's needed the most. And I think we're at a crucial time, and the cowardice cannot be in play at this point, because we don't have any more time for it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've seen two types of people. I've seen the ones that are trying to turn that corner, really trying to steer the ship. And then I see the ones that will, you know, vehemently defend their apathy. And I tell them, like, look, if the way we did it worked, there would be no Behind the Shield podcast, because our first responders would be thriving. They'd perform at a high level. Their marriages would be intact. They'd have a long and fruitful retirement. But that's not the case. So the way we did it, we've got like a 50-year longitudinal study on how not to do it. So let's learn from those lessons, you know, invest in our people. Don't use them as a commodity, but put them as your most valuable resource. And then you will have people not only staying, which is your most important recruitment tool, because happy cops and firefighters will recruit other cops and firefighters.
100%.
But also then, you know, you'll attract these young people, you know, at the front door, and, you know, have, most importantly, in my opinion, someone's given 15, 20, 25 years of their life. Now you ensure that they are healthy when they transition out and get to enjoy the fruits of their labor.
Agreed. I 100% agree with that. And I feel like, you know, we have to be people first, right? And have to put people, you know, in front of us, and, you know that, you know, no matter what, we're going to be taking care of them. And then they have to feel that way too. Like you said, it's like they have to feel like they're taken care of. And, you know, you don't have to hug and coddle and give them a trophy every time they need it. But, you know, they certainly, you know, if there's worth, self-worth, then there's going to be a whole lot more coming out of that.
Absolutely. I've always said I'd much rather a compliment from a chief that I really admired on a fire scene than some unit citation, you know, from a chief that doesn't even know my name. You know what I'm saying?
Hugs and high fives carry a lot more weight than a plaque that's going to sit underneath my bed.
Absolutely. All right. Well, as far as the closing questions, the first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
So I feel like, my wife will always tell you that I'm a buyer of books. Like, I'll buy 100 books, you know, and I'll dig through it and look at it from there. But one of the books, you know, it's more like a guide in a sense, is Ben Greenfield wrote a book. I don't know if you follow him at all, he's a big podcaster, but wrote a book called Boundless. And it's probably this thick. And it's like the mecca of health and wellness. And, you know, it's got all kinds of good data and stuff in there. So, you know, I always revert to that if I'm looking up whether, you know, what kind of workout we're looking at, or there's breathing exercises, or there, you know, what kind of therapies are available, you know, whatever you need to know health wellness related, it's in that book. And, you know, I talk about it often, like I said, because like I said, what put me on my health journey was this guy on his podcast when I listened to it, which then put me on a journey of health and wellness for myself to make myself better, right? And I wouldn't be, I guess, making strides if it wasn't for the steps that this guy is. So, you know, his book Boundless, I tell you, is, you know, while huge, definitely well worth it. It's almost probably gonna be like similar, I guess, to what, you know, Huberman's book for protocols is gonna be, just kind of laying out the foundation. But again, it goes back to foundational work, right?
Absolutely. What about films and documentaries?
Man, we just enjoyed a good movie, Red One, the other day. I don't know if you guys saw that. I was, you know, especially for the time of year right now for Christmas time, but very, very, very good movie. But I, you know, the previews of Superman just had me. I don't know about the dog, but I feel like the new Superman coming out is, you know, be something that, you know, want to start my kids on a new generation, you know, because that was for us growing up, you know, Superman getting released back in, you know, back in the day. And that was, you know, kind of something we saw and looked up upon, right? And, you know, the new superhero needs to step in and, you know, do some work, you know?
Have you seen the documentary they did on Christopher Reeve?
No, I haven't. I saw it online, but I have not watched it, no.
Yeah, it's worth watching. It was amazing. I mean, it's you know, so sad, but, you know, seeing the kind of human story behind that and how, you know, he was at his pinnacle in his acting career and, you know, the impact that that injury had and all the good he still did, even though he was, you know, literally paralyzed from the neck down. It was pretty amazing to watch. All right. Well, the next question, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Yeah. So I would say I get somebody from Boulder Crest, Josh Goldberg, the CEO, man, if you could ever get him on the hook to get him on there, you know, that guy is just such an inspiration. While he's not a military guy, he sure gets it right. And, you know, running such a fantastic organization, you know, if you could ever talk to him or one of his team members, you know, they all speak the same language. And just, you know, Ken Falk, you know, would be his partner in crime. You know, those are the guys that started the Boulder Crest Foundation. Is like, if you can get any of those guys on there to have a conversation with, but I'll tell you, you'll never be disappointed. Like, those guys are just, they're something else, right? But yeah, if I ever had to say a recommendation, you know, well, I don't know if he's, you know, happy that I'm going to throw his name out there, but I definitely would highly recommend, because like I said, I could listen to that guy talk all day long.
Brilliant. Yeah. It's funny. The Struggle Well program there, I've heard mentioned over and over again as well. Yep. So I've got to reach out to them. I haven't had anyone from that, you know, upper echelon of Boulder Crest. So I'll make that happen next year. Definitely.
Oh, I mean, you would not be disappointed. I promise you that.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you online, what do you do to decompress?
Decompression for me, I'm always up for a good run. Whether, you know, we get done it, you know, I enjoy like the different runs that they have, like whether it's the, you know, the Philly, you know, one of the long runs of Philadelphia, or you're going to run, you know, there's a small river by us. That's a 3.5 mile track. Is, that's something that I will never turn down an opportunity to go do something like that. It used to be the Spartan and Tough Mudder races for decompression, but you know, my shoulders and hips aren't working the way they should be anymore, but, so I got to preserve them as best we possibly can. But, I feel like, you know, if I'm going to decompress, you know, I'm going to do that, or we're going to go camping with my family, spend a lot of time with them. And, you know, we spend a lot of time, you know, up at our, you know, family's cabin or down the beach, you know, just kind of enjoying our time together. And that's the only space I'd ever want to be in.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then for people, if they want to reach out to you or learn more about you, where are the best places online?
So I'm on LinkedIn. That's, you know, obviously a professional space that, you know, you keep it professional. It's, you know, it's where it is. You know, all my, you know, my family and stuff, we're all on Instagram and Facebook, but, you know, I spend the time on, you know, LinkedIn, because it's a better platform to share with the like-minded professionals that we serve with, right? And I know your show really attracts a lot of, you know, incredible heroes and human beings. And, you know, I feel like, you know, that's the easiest space to find it.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much. It's been such an amazing conversation, really interesting journey that you've had between all these different roles of law enforcement. And then, and again, your courageous vulnerability, talking about your mental health journey as well. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks, brother. I really appreciate the time. And like I said, I look forward to all you do, and you know, keep doing God's work.